listening to a download from theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Number 510.
Hello and welcome back to The Outdoor Station, the longest running podcast in the world dedicated to outdoor adventure, self-powered travel of all kinds, and appreciation of the world around us, the great outdoors. I'm Bob Cartwright, your host, and since 2005 I've produced over 500 podcasts, which have been downloaded in virtually every country around the world. This is part two, and the continuation of my conversation with adventuress Jenny Tuff. If you haven't already listened to part one, Jenny explains the idea behind her Run the Mountains of the World project, and describes the contrasting experiences of running across Kurdistan and the High Atlas. In this podcast, we continue the story, and once again she shares yet more contrasts running across Bolivia and the Southern Alps of New Zealand.
So the Bolivian Andes were, in every sense, the hardest one so far. I think they hit me with everything that they had. But yeah, the Aymara and the Quechua communities in the Bolivian Andes, they're so lovely. Again, really hospitable people. And they maybe understood mountains and love for mountains a bit more. When people ask me what on earth I'm doing, I would just kind of point up at the snowy peaks above me and say, I just love mountains. They go, oh yeah, that makes sense. So we had that common grounding. But they're in all of South America, but specifically in Bolivia and in the Andes, there's a lot to be afraid of. And I was really afraid on this expedition. I knew that I was running upstream into one of the most important drug smuggling routes in the world. These were the second biggest mountains in the world. So I had that to deal with. Climate change was had just destroyed the dry season. That basically I was getting really bad weather. So I had that to contend with. And Bolivia has some pretty shocking crime rates, specifically crimes against women. It has the worst rate for violence against women in all of South America, which we all know is not a great place to be a woman as it stands. So I was quite afraid of everything. And when I started the expedition, I was so afraid that I tried not to start. I really did try to get out of it. I was like, the morning that I was meant to start, it took me an hour to get out the door because I was just like, oh, I really actually don't want to do this. I'm too scared. This is actually too much for me. And so I have this saying in all my expeditions and my challenges is fix your problems. You know, especially in an endurance challenge, something that lasts for a long time, all your problems only get worse unless you fix them right away. And that's part of expedition life. Expedition life is just a series of fixing problems. And you're the only one who can do it. You know, I do solo unsupported expeditions. That means that if I ignore something, you know, it just gets worse for me. I'm the only person that can address it. So I said, fix your problems. All right, my problem is I'm terrified. Everyone I've spoken to has told me I'm going to get murdered and I'm scared of that. So I came up with this plan that, you know, I would just not see anyone. That was what I was going to do. You know, I had a heavy backpack. Like the routes are quite committed in the Bolivian Andes. They are quite sparse. So I still had like 5 days worth of supplies in my pack. So I was like, I don't actually need to meet anyone. So you know, I can survive in the wilderness. I'm good at that. So my plan is I'm just not going to meet anyone, that I won't meet the cartels and I won't meet the smugglers and I won't meet all these murderers that I'm told exist out here. If I see anyone coming like an adult, I'm just going to jump off the path and hide. And that's what I'm going to do. So that was my plan when I left on the morning of the first day of the expedition was to just keep myself safe and not meet anyone. And then that day I had two passes that were, I think the second one was 4,500 meters. And I got hit by a really bad snowstorm. And I was descending, the lowest altitude I could get to, I think, was 4,200. And there was a village there. And I was running down to the village and it was already after dark and there's snow pelting out my face. And I thought, oh, what was I thinking? You can't do something of this scale without help from people. I'm going to go into this pueblo and, you know, I'm sure they're going to be fine. So I went into the pueblo and I speak a little bit of Spanish. So I went in and I just kind of sheepishly asked, like, look, I don't need anything from you. I have all my supplies, but just if there's a roof that I could sleep under, I'd be really grateful. And these lovely, it was a Quechua community. So they turned and had a little town meeting. They spoke Quechua then. So I just kind of didn't know what was going on. Then they came back to me and they said, you know what, you can sleep in school tonight. We'll unlock the school and you can just have it to yourself because it's a Saturday night. So it's not like, you know, you have to be out early for the kids tomorrow or something like that. And they went and unlocked the school and just gave me the room and said, like, have at her, be warm tonight. And so I went to sleep in the school, sheltered from the storm, just thinking, God, that was so rude. Like, I just felt so bad that I'd spent the entire day with anxiety about this village, thinking, you know, if they see me, they're going to murder me or something like that. Like, what was I thinking? I've been to so many places in the world. I've always proven that these small communities in the mountains are lovely. So what was I, you know, I was just really ashamed of myself that I'd had this moment, this glitch, where I had all this fear. So in the morning when the sun rose, all the village people by then knew I was there. So lots of people came out to meet me and chat to me. And they just wanted to chat about like politics. You know, they thought at the time Evo Morales was in power. So they were like, Evo's the best. And so is Justin Trudeau. And they just wanted to talk about mountains, where I'm from, like differences in lives. So, like, we just had like a lovely conversation. And then just as I had finished packing up my bag and was about to leave, they were like, by the way, Gringo, which way are you going? And I said, oh, I'm going that way. And they go, the next village, murderers, all of them murderers. And then just put that fear right back into my mind. So I just went right back to the same place. And it was like that every day. And that was, isn't that kind of a truth around the world, but certainly rife in the Andes, was no one trusts their neighbors. It's always the next village over. They're always the bad people. You're safe here, but that next village, don't trust them.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds to me like that particular one from the data and the video I've seen of you, that it really was a mental challenge for you as much as a physical one, really, that trying to control this anticipated fear. And I believe that particular one, did you carry a knife with you as well, or you were handed a knife at some stage?
Yeah. I've never armed myself in my life, but it really was a mental battle. I mean, I had all types of fear swimming around my head all day, every day. And that was, you know, partly things that came from me in a rational way. So a lot of those fears were completely rational. I knew what I was up against going to that altitude in the weather that they were experiencing. You know, I knew that I could be on some really committed stretches where no one's coming to save me. I had my little InReach and my SOS button, but I knew realistically, if I got into trouble out there, I was really going to be in trouble. And then there were the irrational ones that, being told that I'm going to get murdered and then really letting that swim around my mind and really letting me think, you know, I literally had to run through coca fields sometimes and thinking to myself, oh God, you know, this is where the murderers probably are. So that kind of irrational fear going on. And then a lot of that also came externally, that everyone that I met without exception told me that this was a bad idea, that I was going to die, and being constantly fed that negativity, constantly seeing the looks on people's faces when they would ask me where I'm going and just see the fear in their eyes when I said I was going to that next village, and they go, oh God, please don't go there, Gringa, you're going to die. That it really did become a massive mental battle with fear. I learned quite a lot about fear. It was really intense to go through that every single day. There wasn't a single day of that expedition where, I mean, maybe the last day when I realized I wasn't going to have to sleep out here again, but you know, I would finish it today and I'd get to go get out of here. But really every single day I woke up just with this incredible fear, this like weight pinning me down into my bivvy of this fear of, this is too much for me. I'm not going to make it through. And then just having to focus on every hour or even half hour or every minute, just get through this, just keep on going right, left, keep on doing the stuff that you're used to doing. It was a massive mental battle.
Did you ever come to any conclusion what made everybody so negative about their neighbours? Was it a national thing? Was it something that was handed down from the government onto everybody's shoulders, do you think?
Yeah, I think it was just kind of ingrained in the culture. And it's weird because there wasn't any, I mean, there are different communities. Obviously, there's Bolivian, Aymara, and Quechua. And I never picked up on any animosity between the communities. So it was never because like the next village doesn't speak our language. It was just always this kind of culture of bad things happen and really focusing on the bad things that do happen. You know, if you did kind of prod someone on it, like people ask me, do I have a gun? And I'd say, no, I don't have a gun. And they go, oof, do you really need a gun? And I'd say, well, why? And they go, oh, well, because this guy has a gun. And they would tell me a story about someone in the next village who definitely does have a gun. He used it one time. And that was just kind of the culture, is focusing on those negatives and really letting those stories survive and thrive in everyone's minds. And that was really all I could glean from it, was just, you know, that things had happened, that, you know, this wasn't completely baseless, but that we were definitely going to focus on these negative things.
Well, once again, I suggest anybody that's listening to this do have a look at the website and the YouTube videos as well. Now, coming on to route number four, there's six in total, two more to go after this one, obviously. Route number four, the real backwoods, the real country that's lost at the edge of the world completely, the wonderful, the glorious and the spectacular New Zealand.
Yes, I went into this one thinking like, this is how I got across Bolivia, was telling myself again and again, if you survive this, you get to go on holiday to New Zealand next. Like, there wasn't another mountain range that would have made sense for Oceania. So that was always going to be the range that I did for that part of the world. And yeah, I did have to look at that as just kind of like this gift within this really gnarly challenge that had been so difficult, was that I was going to go to this Western country that spoke my language, blue skies, GPX files for the trails. You know, like, this wasn't even going to be a planning expedition. Like, I was just going to have real trails to use. So I went into this one actually almost worried that it was too easy. Like, that was my biggest concern in this one, was that I had let myself down, that I was maybe letting down this whole challenge by having this easy one. Again, I always say the mountains punish the confident. Oh my God, it was physically really, really challenging. I mean, mentally it was lovely. I had a little holiday, but yeah, it was physically a really, really hard one. Those Southern Alps, they're steep and they build their trails really steep.
Yeah, did you find the Kiwis were the masters of understatement when they say, yeah, it's a bit of a scramble?
Oh my goodness, exactly. Like, there were so many of their routes. You stand there on the edge of a total cliff thinking to yourself, in the Alps, this would be a via ferrata. They would not let people do this in Europe. What the hell, New Zealand? Like, this is way too steep. Yeah, there was a lot of that. And the concept of one-way trails, did you come across that? I remember seeing sometimes on the maps that this trail is east to west or something like that. And I would go, what? That doesn't make any sense. Trails go both ways. And then you get there and just see it's because of the gradient, because you're definitely going to fall to your death when you do it the wrong way, which I had to do a few times. I think that was my big epiphany, actually, was that in the developing world, all trails exist for people to get somewhere, you know, for people to get to their crops, people to get to work, people to get to the next village for trade. In the Western world, trails exist for leisure. We have that luxury that doesn't exist in the developing world. The middle class would kick off if you made their trails too easy, if you paved them out and made them nice and open. So we get the luxury of gnarly trails. And yeah, in New Zealand, they're either scrambling or swimming, and there doesn't seem to be much in between. I don't think I ran very much.
So in all the experience of these first four trails then, have you ever, now be honest with me now, because I'm sure it's happened, have you ever had any moments where you went, oh, shit?
Oh, tons. I don't even know where to start. Yeah, tons and tons. I made some... I mean, the biggest one, it came early on. It was about halfway through running across Kyrgyzstan. I made a massive navigational error. I'm happy to put my hand up and say that everything that happened that day was my fault. I made a massive navigational error. I went down the wrong valley. And as I went down this valley, there were a lot of landslides that I had to pick over. But as I picked over them, I set them off again. And some massive rocks started tumbling down the mountains. And I decided that, because these are so unstable and I've just made it worse, I'm at a point of no return. Whatever happens in this valley, I'm not coming back the same way I came in, because I'll break. This isn't ankle breakers, this is femur breakers. And so I had made that decision, and then I rounded the corner and the valley turned into a gorge. There was no route ahead. It was a sheer cliff leading into some white water. And so now I had two options, because I couldn't go backwards, I couldn't go forwards. I either had to go down, jump into this white water and find my way through the river, or I had to go up. I had to climb up the mountain that was next to me and get over to the other valley. And I looked at both of them and I realized they were both death on a stick. They both were really bad options. But again, fix your problems. I had to come up with something. So I decided I would take the climb. It looked bad from below. But as I did it, I realized it was way worse than it looked. It was incredibly, yeah, it was a bad scramble. I'm not a good climber. At the time, I was not climbing at all. So it was my own version of free solo. I think if you adjust for skill level, it was as bad as free solo. it wasn't nice. And I knew, I think there was a point of that scramble. Actually, I remember it really well. There was one tree in the middle of the slope. And I thought, if I can get to that tree, I can have a break. Cause this was like, you know, really loose, like the rocks flying off in your hand, that like you can't stop moving because you're going to keep sinking backwards. So I thought, I'll just get to this tree and then I can have a break, because I've been climbing for goodness knows how long, my muscles are screaming. And I got to the tree and I grabbed it, and this tree was about the size of my leg, and the entire thing just came out. It was completely dead. And now suddenly I had a tree the size of my leg in my hand. So I had to drop it. And then, you know, when you drop it and you have to wait until you hear it hit the water below, and how long you have to wait, and have to consider to yourself, that's what I'm committed to. If I slip once, that's how long my fall is. And that was when I realized that any mistake would be my last one. And that really narrows your focus. When you realize that you have just really committed yourself in this way, that you are about to kill yourself if you do this wrong. And it was, I think I stayed calm throughout the rest of that climb. I don't know how long, I've never looked at my GPX file for that, because obviously I did have my tracker on, and I've just never wanted to look, because I don't want to know. I just know how it felt. It's basically like a prolonged near-death experience, knowing that if I make a mistake or if I get too tired, I will die. But I stayed really focused, because you have to stay focused. And I think I was quite calm about it. And I think I just had some really calm thoughts about, you know, if I do die, these are the things I'm going to miss out on. And that's quite sad, thinking about my family and my friends and stuff like that. But I was fine. Like, I stayed focused, got through it. I think it maybe took me a couple hours, but again, I've never looked at the file. It might've been 20 minutes, who knows? And I got to the top. And when I finally realized I wasn't going to die, when I finally stood on solid ground at the top of this hill, this mountain, God, I had the biggest cry of my adult life. The adrenaline just went from my system really, really quickly. And I just dropped to the floor and just, oh, it was so overwhelming. And then on the other side, it was just like a lovely, gentle slope. So I'd already decided I was going to quit this run, that there was no way I was going to keep doing this, because I was obviously incapable. Like, this was a really big mistake that nearly cost me my life. So I promised myself if I survived, I would quit. But I got to the top of this mountain, stood on solid ground, had a big cry, and then just went, okay, well, that was dumb. Picked up my backpack and went back to running. And I just kept going, and didn't reflect on it until I got home. I knew that was something I was going to have to reflect on later, but you know, it's not going to help you during the expedition. So I'm glad that happened on my first big challenge, because that was a big learning experience on check the map 4 times, not twice, not 3 times, 4 times. Be really confident in your choices, because, you know, your choices have consequences in the mountains.
Wow. So really, you know, it's an experience. What's that saying I like? What do you get when you don't get what you want? Experience. So it's an experience that has helped you, I guess, slow down and pace yourself slightly better in the unknown, rather than go rushing in head first.
Yeah, and I think really made me dial in on, this is important and you do have to focus. And it's easy to get caught up in our world at home and the social media world that's going to paint me in whatever light it needs to. But like, at the end of the day, this is real. This is the mountains. They are hard. They will catch you out. I'm here alone, which means that I have to prepare twice as much as anyone else. If you're there in a group, you've got other people to rely on. But when you're alone, you really have to know your stuff. You really have to take care of yourself, because no one else is double checking for you. No one else is doing your safety checks. So that was, yeah, it was a really good experience, and just making me calm down, slow down, just focus on being here and what's important right now and what are you doing right now.
You're listening to The Outdoor Station, the home of UK-based audio and video podcasts for lovers of the great outdoors everywhere.
And that brings us nicely into actually the media and the social media aspect of your adventures as well. As you say, I believe I would class you as a traditional, a true explorer, a true adventurer, as it were, that's certainly with Kurdistan in mind, the approach that you've taken to these things. But obviously, as time's gone by, it's of benefit to you as regards potential help in the future regarding sponsorships and so on, to have a social media presence and a media presence in general. So taking those two topics slightly differently, coming at the first one, do you find that having to record your adventures, your trips, take the photographs, the videos, the stopping and the starting that's always involved, and the thinking through of how the story will look when it's actually seen on video or in photographs, do you find that a hindrance or a help?
I do actually find it a help, but that's something that really surprised me. So I went to Kyrgyzstan. That was the first time I ever took a camera. You know, I'd been doing solo challenges for a long time, and this is the first time that I think on a whim, I bought a GoPro and thought, I'll just see what happens, see how this works. And then I found it, I never thought a piece of technology could do this for you, but I found it made me more mindful of what I was doing, because when I'm doing an endurance challenge, I will put my head down and I'll just hammer my legs and I can go all day like that. And at the end of the day, I can get into my tent, get out my diary and think, right, what did I do today? Oh, I can't remember, because I just went into the zone and I hammered my legs. But having a camera and having made that commitment that I was going to share the story with anyone back home would frequently make me stop and pause and look around and say, oh, if I was going to frame this to tell people what it was like out here, how would I do that? So I actually found that having the camera has made me actually focus on the landscapes that I'm going through and also focus on what I'm thinking and what I'm feeling. That throughout the day, I might chat to the camera and, you know, I don't look at the footage until I get back. And then I get back home and I'll put this up on my own screen and I'll go, gosh, that was what I was like that day, 10 days without having spoken to anyone. And I was just like going through this fear or going through these feelings or whatever it was. And it would just, and that really helps me kind of connect to the reality of the story and really what happened and remember the way that it happened. So actually, I do really love doing it. And I do this because I want people to take on big challenges. You know, I want to inspire people. It doesn't have to be running across mountains. It can be whatever is your, whatever your mountain is. But I want to inspire people to do stuff that's hard, stuff that scares them, to get out of their comfort zones. And the best way that I found to do that is just by showing them the way that I do it and the way that I get through it.
And so what about the social media aspect, as you implied earlier on, about how you're seen by that network, that part of the world, and how you present yourself? Do you start to feel you're wearing two hats, one how you'd like to be seen or how you'd like to tell the story, and the other, the one, the true story?
No, I'm quite lucky that the sponsors that I've worked with certainly don't dictate the way that I communicate. You know, my social media channel is my own, and I write from the heart and I share honestly what's happened, and I don't dress it up or dress it down. I just, I think people that know me know that I just share the stories as they come. And I only share anything if I've got anything to say. I don't like to create a lot of noise. So no, it is a pretty raw image, filter into my life, actually. What I post on there. And like I said, I'm quite lucky with the sponsors that I work with, that they know that and they understand that. And they understand that I'm doing real expeditions and I'm not like a fashion influencer who's just going to put on their jacket and take a nice picture, but that I'm actually doing something that is hard, something that I need to survive. And, you know, I'm going to tell the story the way that I tell it. And I'm quite lucky that anyone wants to work with me and help fund these expeditions that way.
And when did you start picking up the sponsors? Did you start approaching them or did they start approaching you?
I think in the beginning I would have had to approach. I mean, when I ran across Kyrgyzstan, I really didn't use social media very much. And I think I got quite lucky that Sidetracked magazine helped me out a little bit. And then they gave me some connections so I could get a free backpack and a free jacket and that kind of stuff. But obviously it's grown quite a lot. And so I do a lot of public speaking and events that now they sponsor me. They approach me. So now I've gotten a position that I do have a sponsor to get me through the rest of the expeditions. So that's, you know, the social media side, I do it to connect with audiences, to tell people my story and to encourage other people to do cool stuff. And then the bonus side of that is that if you do that well enough, you can make a career out of it. And that's certainly helping keep the show on the road, basically.
And, I mean, talking about the financial side of things, there's obviously the finance of doing any particular trip or expedition that you're aiming for. But the other side of the finances, which a lot of people, I think, probably suffer from when they consider doing something, whether it's a short-term thing or a long-term thing, is actually the finances of still running things back home, the base, as it were. So how do you cover that aspect? Because that can actually be more expensive than doing the trip itself.
Yeah, it typically is, because the stuff that I do isn't actually very expensive when you get there. You know, if you're traveling on foot and staying in these small communities in some of the poor parts of the world, it's, you know, once you pay for the flight, it's actually not that expensive when you get there. But as you say, you do have to keep your overheads of your normal life back home. And I tend to be away half the year. So, you know, I'm paying rent for an empty room half the time. But yeah, that's something that I just factor into the budget every time that I do a budget for a challenge or an expedition. That's the way that you have to calculate it. It's not just how much do flights and food cost. It's how much does your life cost, and then plus flights and food. So yeah, I just factor it in and know that that's the amount of money that I'll need to make it happen.
Do you think that there's more of an elegance in simple, lightweight travel as opposed to taking lots of bags and lots of gear and then relying on things? Oh, well, lots of tech rather than on lots of bags. So you're relying more on what you know than what gear you have with you?
Yeah, I think so. I was having a conversation with a friend about this a while ago, and we were talking about, you know, how I said earlier that when I started doing these challenges, I just had the cheapest gear in the shop. So my bags were quite heavy. And we were just talking about the concept of this technology advancements. You know, people have been doing big expeditions. People have been climbing Everest for decades. People have been doing these really cool stuff far before we had Gore-Tex, far before we had all the materials and all the technology that we have now. That means my pack never weighs more than 7 kilograms. And that's kind of unheard of. 20 years ago, you wouldn't be taking the same kit list as I have now for 7 kilograms. It just wouldn't be happening. So I do think it's important not to get caught up on that side and think, you know, the gear is the most essential part, because you do, at the end of the day, just have to, I think, suck it up a little bit and make it happen within a margin of safety, obviously. But yeah, I think there's something that's nice about just doing a pure challenge and just saying this is more about the movement, this is more about getting to that place and making it work, and not getting caught up in how you can buy things to make it better and easier or safer or whatever, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Certainly looking at your rucksack weight and the type of gear you take with you, could you just quickly run through what an average expedition that we've touched on might consider as regards equipment you carry with you to give people an idea of preparation?
So sleep system, I really stripped that one back. So I use a hydrophobic sleeping bag, which means I don't take a bivy sack. I actually just sleep out in the sleeping bag itself, and a ground mat. And the weight of both of those will depend on how cold it gets. I'll obviously go as light as I can, but I do sleep cold. So I want to make sure that I sleep. So probably the thing that I would most likely invest in and care the most about is actually going to be my sleep system. So it is just a bivy sack and a mat, and maybe weather dependent, I might take an emergency tarp. That's about the size of my fist anyway, so it's not a big hindrance. And then I'll always have a stove in the mountains. I think that's a safety thing. You know, if you have to do a river crossing and then you got hypothermia, how are you going to fix that? You need to get warm. So I always have a tiny, tiny stove. That's also the best way to treat your water. If you're really worried about your water, boiling it is better than the other methods. So.
And that's a gas stove?
Yeah. That's the only one I have. I think a multi-fuel one would be smart investment one day. But yeah, I just have a little gas stove, just a tiny thing. And so sleep system, your food systems, whatever dehydrated food that's going to go with the stove. Safety equipment, again, I do the Garmin. And so I'll have spare battery packs with me to keep my devices charged. So like my camera, my phone, my Garmin, maybe my watch if I've got one. And then other basics, like I always take trekking poles, carbon fiber trekking poles. I think it's just a lot easier when you've got a pack on you. Things like your first aid kit, which for me is usually like ibuprofen and a knife or something like that. I'm not great at that side. Duct tape, obviously. Your water filtration. And then as far as clothing goes, you get one of everything, no more, no less. So I'll be running in kind of probably merino wool and a pair of shorts, and then I'll have a base layer, an insulated layer, and a waterproof, and then a toque, which is the Canadian word for bobble hat, and that's it.
And
keep it light.
Your battery backup system, are you solar powered as well? Do you take a solar charger in some way?
I don't actually, because I can only carry, I know usually I can carry about 4 to 6 days worth of food. So I know that within 4 to 6 days, I need to get to a village anyways. So I'll just recharge my batteries when I get there. So that's the way that I've always done it, is I know I'm going to have to go to a village anyways. So they'll have electricity and I'll sort it out there.
I noticed on the New Zealand video, there was a drone footage as well. Are you now to carrying a drone with you?
There was a bit of artistic license that was filmed after I finished the challenge. I don't carry a drone across the mountain range with me. I'm not that hard.
And so finally then, what's the camera that you use? Because obviously it's taking videos and stills at the same time.
It's just a compact camera, I think is what it's called. I don't know a lot about cameras. It's black. It's small.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just a standard compact that shoots in 4K, and I really don't even know what it's called.
Well, that's nice and honest of you. The footwear that you use, it looks like, from what I could see, there are Salomons.
Yeah, I've changed it up every time, actually, depending on the terrain. Like, I'm quite lucky with my feet that I can kind of get away with anything that I put on them. But yeah, it depends on the terrain. So like the Atlas were so dry that you don't need grip, you just need cushioning. So I went with a much higher heel drop on that one. That was like a pair of Lux Sportivas, I think. And Bolivian Andes, I was doing a lot of double track. So it was a lot of gravel roads. And I was actually sponsored by Merrell to do that one. And they had me in one of their trail shoes that were actually quite minimalist. And that was really comfortable. And they were Gore-Tex, which was lovely because it rained on me every single day. So I switch it up depending on what the terrain is.
And so the actual trips that you've done then, do you find the approach shoes last the trip okay and last longer? Because generally I find that as much as I use the lightweight shoes these days and get a quality journey out of them, they don't last as many miles as I'd like them to.
They'll be hanging on by a prayer by the end, but I've never had to trash a shoe before I finished yet. You know, I might be adding bits of duct tape, or there might be, like, I think when I finished across New Zealand, there were like holes all over my shoes and the sole was falling off, but I could still move, you know. I wasn't going to use them again, but I was still able to keep moving. So, I mean, shoes are meant to last you 1,000 miles. They're meant to. So I'm not going that far, but I'm maybe putting them through a little bit more than they were made for. But yeah, I mean, a fresh pair of shoes should get you across the mountain range.
You've mentioned in the past that how much you used to get your head down and focus on doing the miles, and perhaps the experiences that you've had obviously have enabled you, and using certainly creating the media, enabled you to capture the experience more for either personal memories or obviously to share the story. How do you view diet and the actual camping itself? Is food to you just fuel, or do you enjoy your food and like to experiment when you're out with different ideas, whether it's eating with the nomads or eating whatever you take with you? And then as regards the camping itself, do you literally get to a point where, okay, I can't go any further, I'm going to camp now, or are you someone that actually takes pride in finding a nice camping spot?
So food, if I'm in civilization, then I certainly like to be involved in whatever the normal cuisine is there. If nomads have invited me in, or if I'm in a village or something like that, then I do like to enjoy whatever the local is. I don't have a lot of restrictions there. As far as the stuff that I carry in my pack that I'm going to be making in my tiny little camp stove, that is food is fuel. You know, it's not going to be nice. It's going to be something that's dehydrated. I'm not a foodie, so I don't care. As long as I eat enough that I'm not like getting hangry, then I'm good. I don't really put a lot of time and effort and thought into it. I just make sure that I do have enough to get to the next supply point, and that's all I really care about. Sleeping, it'll certainly depend on the objective. These ones I am trying to, I mean, the longer that you're out there, the harder it is. You want to get across the mountain range as fast as you can. Because the more days that you're out there, the more days you're exposed to it, the more you're going to wear down your body and get exhausted. So I do try to go as far as I can every day. Sometimes that does mean that I set up my bivvy in the dark. But every now and then, I will give myself a gift of a nice campsite, or maybe it's only 5 p.m. and I pass somewhere that's just absolutely stunning. And I think, you know, I might remember this my whole life, so it's worth stopping here. I won't do that very often, but I will every now and then.
Well, it sounds like you've hit the balance nicely on that score. That's really good to hear.
Try to have a balance, yeah.
you're enjoying the journey, not just the destination.
Supper,
you know?
Fest.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
All right, well, just changing the subject slightly, let's get on to coolness. I understand that the coolest parents in the world, certainly listening to this, must be your parents, Murray and Joy.
Kathy, her Instagram name is Joy. I don't know why. Her name's Kathy.
Oh, right. Okay, I do apologise. Murray and Kathy. They've taken you to some wonderful experiences looking back on it. Obviously, that the trip to Bahamas at such an early age. How, in the scale of 1 to 10, how cool are your parents?
Oh, I think I have to say 11, don't I? Yeah, they are cool. And they continue to be cool. I get asked all the time how my parents survive what I do, how they manage to be supportive, how they manage to stomach this. And they are really supportive. They're still cool. They're still doing their own travel. My mom obviously does worry, but we have a really good policy of I tell her all about my trip after I get home and I've survived it. Up until that point, I just tell her kind of vague outlines of what I'm doing and how safe it's going to be. But yeah, they're really supportive of what I do and definitely help shape me into what I do.
Were they travelers themselves in their 20s, early years, teens?
They did travel. They certainly did the traditional life of they met at university and got married then, and then they moved all around Canada, so they moved in lots of different provinces and had good careers and, you know, had a house, had their kids when they were in their late 20s, so they didn't adventure on that scale, but yeah, they did always travel and do their holidays abroad. They didn't just do boring, like, you know, the typical Canadian would just be like package holidays to Mexico. They didn't do that kind of stuff. They would like to travel more.
Well, I think there's another aspect that people won't know about you, that you seem to have a secret fetish that I think is might be worth sharing.
So scared. What's this?
you cross these mountain ranges. You do these amazing expeditions. You do a phenomenal amount of cycle touring or cycle expeditions as well. But I understand that obviously in the downtime when you're recovering from all this and you've put your body through a lot and it takes time for it to recover, you stay in your room, wherever that may be, and you knit the toques or bubble hats.
I'm so bad at them. I'm still not good at them.
Well, I looked at the video. You look good in those.
Yeah, I think I needed something to do with my hands that wasn't drinking wine. So I picked up knitting and I make these terrible bobble hats, and it's just like, or obviously I call them toques because that's Canadian. You just don't want to be one of my friends because then you just end up getting a toque as a gift and it's not a nice gift. My toques are awful. They fall apart.
I have this vision, you buying a pile of wool at the end of each expedition and taking it home and making toques.
That is exactly what I do.
Excellent. I've hit the spot there. Excellent. You see what a little bit a little bit of cyber stalking will do? Okay. So we've covered the four expeditions you've got in your plan. Now, in 2020, we're just coming into that now, you're aiming to do the Caucasus Mountains and the Canadian Rockies. All I can do is wish you well and ask that we could possibly speak to you at the end of that to see how they compared to the previous four. But there is one final question which I must ask you, and it's going to be a very interesting one, I think. I love asking this question, and you've had such a history, we've had such a great conversation, that I'm going to be enthralled to hear what you say. But of all the things I could have asked you about all the expeditions that you've done, what should I have asked you?
Oof. Oh, that wasn't a knitting question. I guess, you know, there's something that really surprises me when people want to speak to me about my expeditions. They always want to focus on, I guess, the things that that are easy to grasp. Like, how far did you run? What did you eat? Where did you sleep? That stuff's genuinely the easiest part of the expeditions. You know, the hardest part is the stuff that's going on inside your head, the interactions that you have with people, the interactions that you have with the landscape. You know, running, eating, and sleeping, those are things that I've done my entire life. I know how to do those ones. It's the other parts of the expedition that are difficult. And I've always found it really difficult to communicate with people that, you know, running 50 kilometers a day wasn't impressive. It wasn't hard. That was something that I knew how to do and something that I enjoyed doing. It was convincing myself to get up that mountain pass that looked really scary, or to go into that village where I was terrified of the men and stuff like that. It's that pushing myself in that regard and being outside my comfort zone for that long that, for me, is the most impressive part of these expeditions and stuff that I'm most proud of. So I don't know how you frame that as a question, but I think that's actually the hardest and most interesting part of expedition life.
What a great conversation, and I do hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. Once again, my thanks go to Jenny for taking the time, and more about her, her adventures, and much more background information, pictures, and videos can all be found on her website, jennytuff.com. Please take a few moments to share this podcast or drop me some feedback, either on social media or via the outdoorstation.co.uk website. While you're there, why not join our newsletter and suggest future guests with fascinating stories to tell? You may have noticed more women in recent interviews, and it could be that they're getting out there and enjoying the journey more than the guys at the moment. So, I wonder who you'll suggest I talk to next. With that thought in mind, take care out there, and bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.